We always begin these sessions together with some Sanskrit chants from the Indian spiritual tradition. The first two come as peace chants, prefatory to the beginnings of certain Upanishads, the very core of Vedantic teaching. And the first one, of course, calls us to a recognition of what is our spiritual family, and that we strive to be filled with spiritual energy, with spiritual light, and that living in harmony, living in oneness, we do not hate. That second is the opening to the Isha Upanishad, which was the foundation of Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, affirming the reality of this magnificent world. And it says, that is full, this is full, the full is taken out of the full. If you take the full out of the full remains. The foundation of oneness is never lost, whether abstracted into the silent, immaculate Brahman, transcendent to all space and time, or immanent, deeply engaged and invested in the world. It is the same reality. The third is a call to remind us what we are. Asatoma sadgamaya. Lead me from what is not our real being to what is our real being. From darkness to light. From death to immortality. Because that is what we are. We truly are. Light is our veriest nature. And we are in our very essence, indestructible. Your soul can be recycled endlessly, wearing out form after form after form, but you cannot be dissolved. And the last one, of course, is a call to light, to let that light, this is a recasting that Sri Aurobindo gave us of a Gayatri mantra phrased so that we call that truth down into manifestation in us here upon earth. Not there. We can climb there. We can visit those supreme summits. But can we bring them here? That is the question. That is the quest. And so tonight we come to the synthesis of yoga, all of these things that we're talking about, coming back to our true nature, living in harmony with each other, striving towards personal discovery, personal transformation, leading to a larger social transformation, all the things that we want to do, and living in concert in a great, magnificent universe, carrying it forward on the crest wave of an evolution. It comes back to our personal practice. It comes back to unifying our nature and unifying that nature in real being. This was what led to this grand conjunction of energies, philosophies in 1914 when Mira Richard, Paul Richard met Sri Aurobindo in Pondicherry. And after a month and a half or so, asked him, could we start a philosophic journal? And since his motto was that a yogin should be able to turn his hand to anything, he said yes, even though he said he is not a philosopher. He had been there in Pondicherry since 1910, practicing an intense solitary yoga. And we have a record of yoga. depicting, at least to some extent, what his inner life was then. It's unique in the annals of spiritual history. Nobody in the field of yoga has ever done such a thing. And he never published it. Nobody even knew it existed. It was discovered, if I remember correctly, by M.P. Pundit, going through some materials in a chiffon robe that had been left in his office by Nalini Kantagupta. He found this vast array of materials and started reading it and recognized Sri Aurobindo's handwriting and put it down, took it to Nalini. And from there, it made its way to archives and research. And after a long discussion within archives and research and with others, it was decided that these materials could be published. And that record of yoga, when you look at Sri Aurobindo's synthesis of yoga, you see, especially in its last section on the yoga of self-perfection, that there is much overlap. In fact, you can see that this early scheme that he had, say around 1910, 1911, he had a full vision of what his yoga would be, what his sadhana would lead to. So when we take up the synthesis of yoga, it is matched beautifully to his vision as expressed in The Life Divine. The Life Divine, his magnum opus, is the large cosmic vision, the omnipresent reality. Here, in the synthesis of yoga, he describes in large terms how one can live in that, how one can experience that, and take every part of your being, the inmost soul and the most external natural parts, and yoke them in that experience. And it's when you do that that you can change the earth most powerfully. So we'll go through the synthesis of yoga in its introductory chapters, and we'll spend a good deal of time looking at the Yoga of Divine Works, the one section that Sri Aurobindo came back and meticulously rewrote and grafted new material into as he developed his own understanding of the yoga. Because yes, as he lived, he evolved, he changed, and he wanted to refashion the material. Really, he wanted to rewrite the entirety of the synthesis of yoga. He never had that opportunity. But we have Savitri, his epic poem. Tonight, we start with the synthesis of yoga, and before we do, I want to recall that it appeared in the pages of Arya, a philosophic journal, started with the three, Sri Aurobindo, Mira and Paul Richard. And its first issue was on the 15th of August in 1914. World War I, the Great War, was already underway, as if to defy the downcoming of this great truth which wanted to manifest in the world. Always we find darkness rising to try to obstruct. We won't be deterred. We have a sense of humor. This is a copy of the first issue of the Arya. This is, I should say, the first issue of Arya. And you can see it has a monthly review. It has a statement over here of what it intends to do. It says, the review will publish Synthetic Studies in Speculative Philosophy, Translations and Commentaries of Ancient Texts, studies in comparative religion, practical methods of inner culture and self-development. And you can see that this is The Life Divine, page one. 36 pages later, we come to the synthesis of yoga. If you remember how striking and extraordinary his initial paragraphs were in The Life Divine, the synthesis of yoga has similar power. And it is a pity that if I read all the pages to you, then went back and read them again, I would probably make you a little sleepy. So rather than do that, we'll go straight into the material in the synthesis of yoga with this first chapter in his introduction. Chapter 1, Life and Yoga, which came to the notice of the public on the 15th of August, Sri Aurobindo's birthday in 1914. There are two necessities of nature's workings, which seem always to intervene in the greater forms of human activity, whether these belong to our ordinary fields of movement or seek those exceptional spheres and fulfillments which appear to us high and divine. Every such form tends towards a harmonized complexity and totality, which again breaks apart into various channels of special effort and tendency, only to unite once more in a larger and more puissant synthesis. This idea about the harmonized complexity, rising, is reminiscent of a theory that appeared in the middle part of the last century, say, promulgated by Ilya Prigozhin. Dissipative structures, that when you have a closed system, not much can happen, but when you have an open system and it admits influences from outside, those influences challenge the stability of that system. But because of the challenge, there arises a sudden point of transformation where everything is seemingly thrown into disarray. But what comes out of the crisis is a transition into a new phase of being, and the open system becomes richer, more sophisticated, and almost seemingly unrelated to its previous state. We move from the simple to the complex, from the poor to the rich, all in a stroke. And this seems to be how evolution might work. So what Sri Aurobindo is saying here presages such a theory by some decades. Next sentence. Secondly, development into forms is an imperative rule of effective manifestation. Let's pause and remember what manifest means. Manifest means to bring forward, to make clear. So a manifestation is not a creation. It was always there. It was held in potency, but coming forward, it assumes actuality. No, that doesn't mean it wasn't essentially real always. It was, but now it stands forward. So secondly, development into forms is an imperative rule of effective manifestation. For the divine to manifest its essence into the formulation of a cosmos or the formulation of a person, form must be accepted, and form seems to limit, and yet what the form hails from and harbors within it is always that timeless, spaceless, absolute reality. Yet all truth and practice, too strictly formulated, becomes old and loses much, if not all, of its virtue. It must be constantly renovated by fresh streams of the Spirit, reviving the dead or dying vehicle and changing it if it is to acquire a new life. To be perpetually reborn is the condition of a material immortality. Ah, material immortality is not a goal that comes into sight with the appearance of the integral yoga of Sri Aurobindo. This is an idea that has long been held. It's been held in China in Taoistic philosophy and practice. It's been held in tantric philosophy, theory, and practice over the millenniums, all the way from, say, the 7th, 6th century, all the way up until Sri Vidya is codified in South India. And even to this day, the idea is that the immortal being, which is inside in our psychological depths, could, can, potentially manifest itself into physical form and make divine the very body that seems to inhabit it, because actually the body sits inside this immortal spirit, not vice versa. So this idea of a material immortality, Sri Aurobindo notes here. We are in an age full of the throes of travail. Travail is birth. It is the process of giving birth to a child. So it's extraordinarily painful, the most painful thing you'll ever experience. But on the other side of that experience, of the travail, is the birth of a new being. We are in an age full of the throes of travail, when all forms of thought and activity that have in themselves any strong power of utility or any secret virtue of persistence are being subjected to a supreme test and given their opportunity of rebirth. We just said the Great War was underway. All of Europe was aflame with this conflict. Every tradition, every culture, all that was human, and let alone the nature that underlies it all, was under threat and had to prove the worth of its existence to be able to persist and come out the other side. The world today presents the aspect of a huge cauldron of Medea, in which all things are being cast, shredded into pieces, experimented on, combined and recombined, either to perish and provide the scattered material of new forms, or to emerge rejuvenated and changed for a fresh term of existence. Poetic, but if you know Greek myth, Medea, the great sorceress, had the power to place beings into a cauldron and bring them out new. In fact, through her guile, she convinced the daughters of Peleus to take their old father and chop him up into bits and throw him into this cauldron so that he could come out new, reborn. To demonstrate her power, she took an old ram and cut it into bits, tossed it into this boiling cauldron, and threw some pharmaka, some medicines, some herbs into the cauldron, stirred it, and out came a skipping young lamb, replacing the now gone old ram. So the daughters thought, this is a grand idea, and very willingly chopped up their father, thinking they would do him a great good. But alas, Medea did not throw in the pharmaca, and he simply boiled and died. He was irretrievably dead. So the idea of a huge cauldron in which all things are being cast, cultures, old customs, civilizations, philosophies, sciences, everything is going in to come back out of it. And her cauldron is called the cauldron of rejuvenation. And he uses that word here, or to emerge rejuvenated and changed for a fresh term of existence. So Sri Aurobindo, the classically trained scholar, finds a way to bring Greek mythology into the first page of the synthesis of yoga. Indian yoga, in its essence, a special action or formulation of certain great powers of nature, itself specialized, divided, and variously formulated, is potentially one of these dynamic elements of the future life of humanity. So, particularly he's talking about this spiritual path of inner culture and self-development, which can be separated out into every flavor of yoga that is popular now, or can be brought back into a dynamic oneness. But yoga can be a dynamic element in the transformation and continuation of the human species as it evolves beyond the current crisis. He was writing in 1914, it still applies. Yoga can still serve in that way. Excuse me. The child of immemorial ages, preserved by its vitality and truth into our modern times, it is now emerging from the secret schools, Tantra, and ascetic retreats, sannyasa, in which it had taken refuge, and is seeking its place in the future sum of living human powers and utilities. In other words, don't stand outside anymore. Come back. Come back into the life of the earth. Come back into human society. No more this renunciation. Now it is time to take your riches and apply them to the development of a better future. He continues. But it has first to rediscover itself, bring to the surface the profoundest reason of its being in that general truth and that unceasing aim of nature which it represents, and find, by virtue of this new self-knowledge and self-appreciation, its own recovered and larger synthesis. So again, what is a synthesis? It means, from the Greek, together with. It means placing things together, making a whole out of parts. So all these various truths that each of the yogas represents have to be pulled back into unity, work in unison with each other, all get constellated in one being, and not represent separable achievements, but all achievements be present at once. He continues, reorganizing itself, it will enter more easily and powerfully into the reorganized life of the race, which its processes claim to lead within into the most secret penetralia and upward to the highest altitudes of existence and personality. Penetralia means the inmost parts, or the most holy place, or the place where exist the innermost mysteries. So if we will bring all of these powers together, we can bring them out from inside and manifest them outside in an exuberant and divinized life. In the right view, both of life and of yoga, all life is either consciously or subconsciously a yoga. For we mean by this term a methodized effort towards self-perfection by the expression of the secret potentialities latent in the being and highest condition of victory in that effort, a union of the human individual with the universal and transcendent existence we see partially expressed in man and in the cosmos. So you remember in The Life Divine, he targets for us, assesses for us what the three great terms of being are: the transcendent, beyond all manifestation, the absolute, the cosmic, a partial representation of that absolute in space and time, in all the various fields, inner and outer. And then, of course, the individual, representing both the transcendence and the universal. And he continues from here. Let's see. Existence, as he says, we see partially expressed in man and in the cosmos, meaning there's much more up there, around us, inside us, below us. But all life, when we look behind its appearances, is a vast yoga of nature, who attempts in the conscious and the subconscious to realize her perfection in an ever-increasing expression of her yet unrealized potentialities, and to unite herself with her own divine reality. So nature is always trying to find a way to bring to optimization, to bring out the riches that she has within. She wants to bring them out, wants to display them. And it is ongoing in all of nature. There's no aspect of nature which is not involved in this cosmic yoga. He continues, in man, her thinker, she for the first time upon this earth devises self-conscious means and willed arrangements of activity by which this great purpose may be more swiftly and puissantly attained. Yoga, as Swami Vivekananda has said, may be regarded as a means of compressing one's evolution into a single life or a few years or even a few months of bodily existence. Swami Vivekananda, the great champion of Sri Ramakrishna, who came to the West and brought Vedanta to America, gave an address in America, which is recorded in his Jnana Yoga, chapter 13, titled Immortality. This is evolution. But we have seen that each evolution presupposes an involution. The whole of this life, which slowly manifests itself, evolves itself from the protoplasm to the perfected human being, the incarnation of God on earth. The whole of this series is but one life, and the whole of this manifestation must have been involved in that very protoplasm. Swami Vivekananda. So you can see the whole in the small, an expression of the whole. From the beginning, the involution of conscious being into matter, and the evolution out of matter into full awareness. So Sri Aurobindo is crediting Swami Vivekananda, for whom he had a great affinity and admiration. And not expressed here, of course, is the philosophy and the yoking of this idea of a conscious evolution that theosophy brought to the West and then later to the East. So as soon as evolution was articulated by Charles Darwin and then later by Alexander and others, it was seen that evolution can't simply be a changing of external forms. It must also be secretly the emergence of a consciousness upon earth. Sri Aurobindo is the best visionary to give voice to what this means. And this very paragraph is addressing that. So he writes now, a given system of yoga, then, can be no more than a selection or a compression into narrower but more energetic forms of intensity of the general methods which are already being used loosely, largely, in a leisurely movement, with a profuser apparent waste of material and energy, but with a more complete combination by the Great Mother and her vast upward labor. So the Great Mother, the Mahashakti, Lalitambika, who is using every possible form to manifest what is her nature, to make it stand forth as part of her cosmic dance. Act one, act two, act three. For then, yoga ceases to appear something mystic and abnormal, which has no relation to the ordinary processes of the world energy or the purpose she keeps in view in her two great movements of subjective and objective self-fulfillment. It reveals itself rather as an intense and exceptional use of powers that she has already manifested or is progressively organizing in her less exalted but more general operations. So, yogic methods have something of the same relation to the customary psychological workings of man as has the scientific handling of the force of electricity or of steam to their normal operations in nature. And they too, like the operations of science, are formed upon a knowledge developed and confirmed by regular experiment, practical analysis, and constant result. Now, behind all of this, Sri Aurobindo is keeping his record of yoga, in which he is making conscious experiments with all the apparatus of human life. How can I make my mind serve this higher spirit with which I am in communion? How can I uplift my vital energies? How can I take the small bit of energy that I get from the food that I eat here and greaten it by entering into commerce with the larger vital force in the world? How can I make this body more plastic and strong living inside this 10 by 10 room? And so he attaches every process of his life, and I do mean every process that occurs within the human body, every emotion that you feel, every sensation that grips you, every thought that delights you, that beguiles you, that illuminates you, and brings them all into the compass of how can this lead to the experience of that one being who is everywhere. And so illumined and so energized can I reconstruct this personal life. He's working on this constantly. And now, saying that each thread of this, the warp and the woof that this life is, can be brought to bear, not just for me, but for the whole, because it is a cosmic context in which this is being done. An individual works out an answer that the whole can use, that addresses a cosmic need, you see. So there is no wasted motion. When you make an advance in your yoga, it counts for the world. You are changing the world with which you are in contact. You are part of a context. You never exist in isolation from the world. You are always connected to it. Your experience matters. Your self-change is crucially important for the change of the earth. All Raja Yoga, for instance, depends on this perception and experience that our inner elements, combinations, functions, forces can be separated or dissolved, can be new combined and set to novel and formerly impossible workings, or can be transformed and resolved into a new general synthesis by fixed internal processes. So Raja Yoga, the royal yoga, which asks you to stand back and take a general survey of all the elements of thought, life, and body, and standing free from them, come back in and then set them right. Find out the imperfections from inside and change the system. Hatha Yoga similarly depends on this perception and experience that the vital forces and functions to which our life is normally subjected and whose ordinary operations seem set and indispensable can be mastered and the operations changed or suspended with results that would otherwise be impossible and that seem miraculous to those who have not seized the rationale of their process. So Hatha, the difficult, the forceful yoga, Hatha Yoga, which is, we'll talk more about it when we get to it as a subject. yes, let's do that. And he continues, and if in some other of its forms, this character of yoga is less apparent because they are more intuitive and less mechanical, nearer like the yoga of devotion to a supernal ecstasy, or like the yoga of knowledge to a supernal infinity of consciousness and being, yet they too start from the use of some principal faculty in us by ways and for ends not contemplated in its everyday spontaneous workings. So the instruments that we have are not casual. They can be purposeful. The capacities that we have can be yoked to a divine will, can be reunited with divinity in essence, divinity in being, and stand forward as manifestations directly of that. All these possibilities lie untapped, undiscovered, in the human body, in the human emotions, and all that is clouded and dark in us, as well as in what is illumined in us. There is a greater reality waiting to stand forward. We are living on the superficies of what nature can offer. Great depths are there, waiting for our exploration. All methods grouped under the common name of yoga are special psychological processes founded on a fixed truth of nature and developing out of normal functions, powers, and results which were always latent, but which your ordinary movements do not easily or do not often manifest. So these powers that we think are miraculous, as exhibited by yogins and yoginis, no, they're the beginning of the truth of what nature can do. But as in physical knowledge, the multiplication of scientific processes has its disadvantages, as that tends, for instance, to develop a victorious artificiality which overwhelms our natural human life under a load of machinery and to purchase certain forms of freedom and mastery at the price of an increased servitude. So the preoccupation with yogic processes and their exceptional results may have its disadvantages and losses. Whatever the nature of the technology, whether it's a psychotechnology or a physical technology, we can be seduced by the apparent ease and wonder and fruit that it offers to us. So we have always to be sagacious in our use of these technologies. Let's not be slaves to the external. The yogin tends to draw away from the common existence and lose his hold upon it. He tends to purchase wealth of spirit by an impoverishment of his human activities. The inner freedom by an outer death. And obviously he refers here to the reclusive or stand-away life that the yogin in India has typically led, has characteristically led over the last several centuries. We'll come back to that point. If he gains God, he loses life. Or if he turns his efforts outward to conquer life, he is in danger of losing God. Therefore, we see in India that a sharp incompatibility has been created between life in the world and spiritual growth and perfection. And although the tradition and ideal of a victorious harmony between the inner attraction and the outer demand remains, it is little or else very imperfectly exemplified. Well, the Vedic goal of an affirmative spirituality has much receded, and the tantric goals have been clouded, as you know. So his point is well taken. In fact, when a man turns his vision and energy inward and enters on the path of yoga, he is popularly supposed to be lost inevitably to the great stream of our collective existence and the secular effort of humanity. Well, because practicing yoga means renouncing the world, so if you live in India, you're a good son or a good daughter, go in and tell your parents that you're going to leave the world to go practice yoga and see their reaction. You'll have fun. So strongly has the idea prevailed, so much has it been emphasized by prevalent philosophies and religions, that to escape from life is now commonly considered as not only the necessary condition, but the general object of yoga. No synthesis of yoga can be satisfying which does not, in its aim, reunite God and nature in a liberated and perfected human life, or in its method, not only permit, but favor the harmony of our inner and outer activities and experiences in the divine consummation of both. For man is precisely that term and symbol of a higher existence descended into the material world, in which it is possible for the lower to transfigure itself and put on the nature of the higher, and the higher to reveal itself in the forms of the lower. To avoid the life which is given him for the realization of that possibility can never be either the indispensable condition or the whole and ultimate object of his supreme endeavor or of his most powerful means of self-fulfillment. It can only be a temporary necessity under certain conditions, or a specialized extreme effort imposed on the individual so as to prepare a greater general possibility for the race. The true and full object and utility of yoga can only be accomplished when the conscious yoga in man becomes, like the subconscious yoga in nature, outwardly conterminous with life itself, and we can once more, looking out both on the path and the achievement, say in a more perfect and luminous sense, all life is yoga. So yes, there can be a moment, there can be an individual's life which is turned to severance from the human society to gain the liberation that's necessary. But then that has to be brought back at some point into the orbit of human life and become a generalized possibility. But for us, this idea is central. All life is yoga. All the world is moving towards a conscious goal. It feels called back to that. It seeks its reunion. Every time we try to satisfy an appetite or a desire, we're looking for fullness of being again. We're trying to move from partiality to wholeness. That's what we're really seeking. And so every form that we pick up and play with tends to disappoint because we're not satisfied until we get back into that grand experience where we are one with that and one with all around, where perfected in our psychology, we are perfected in harmony in society as well. We are a long way from that, but we must become conterminous with life in our spiritual altitudes. So conterminous is a word that simply means coincident, adjacent, meeting, intersecting, neighboring. So it's a great first chapter. Can you imagine, as Kapali Shastriya would have found, when this first issue of Arya arrived, and he opened it up, and he found the Life Divine announcing a new possibility, a new range of evolution opening up. When he looked at the Isha Upanishad and saw clearly that here is the foundation of Vedanta, all this is the manifestation of Brahman. All this is the habitation of the Lord, of a conscious being. When he went to the synthesis of yoga and saw this reconciliation of all yogic possibilities in one grand vision, what he would have experienced. Well, what he did was read every page of the Arya, that first issue, every day until the next issue came out, and then he read every page of that every day, front to back, until the next issue came out. So it went on like that until Sri Aurobindo got tired of this mental exercise of publishing the Arya and quit it in 1921. Only part of the way through, the Yoga of Self-Perfection, the final section in the synthesis of yoga, when it was published. Well, we're grateful for what we have. It is the large lines that Sri Aurobindo makes plain to us in the synthesis of yoga, and I think we'll enjoy going forward. For this moment, we'll go to Savitri, Forward to Savitri, his epic poem. And I'm going to read a section, if I have the voice, from Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 2, The Kingdom of Subtle Matter. This begins on page 108. A mighty kinship is this daring's cause. All we attempt in this imperfect world looks forward or looks back beyond time's gloss to its pure idea and firm inviolate type in an absolute creation's flawless skill. To seize the absolute in shapes that pass, to fix the eternal's touch in time-made things, this is the law of all perfection here. A fragment here is caught of heaven's design. Else could we never hope for greater life, and ecstasy and glory could not be. Even in the littleness of our mortal state, even in this prison house of outer form, a brilliant passage for the infallible flame is driven through gross walls of nerve and brain. A splendor presses or a power breaks through, Earth's great dull barrier is removed a while. The inconscient seal is lifted from our eyes, and we grow vessels of creative might. The enthusiasm of a divine surprise pervades our life. A mystic stir is felt. A joyful anguish trembles in our limbs. A dream of beauty dances through the heart. A thought from the eternal mind draws near. Intimations cast from the invisible, awaking from infinity's sleep, come down. Symbols of that which never yet was made. But soon the inert flesh responds no more. Then sinks the sacred orgy of delight. The blaze of passion and the tide of power are taken from us, and though a glowing form abides, astonishing earth, imagined supreme, too little of what was meant has left a trace. Earth's eyes half see, her forces half create. Her rarest works are copies of heaven's art. A radiance of a golden artifice, a masterpiece of inspired device and rule, her forms hide what they house and only mime the unseized miracle of self-born shapes that live forever in the eternal's gaze. Here, in a difficult, half-finished world, is a slow toiling of unconscious powers. Here is man's ignorant divining mind, his genius born from an inconscient soil. To copy on earth's copies is his art. For when he strives for things surpassing earth, too rude the workman's tools, too crude his stuff, and hardly with his heart's blood he achieves his transient house of the divine idea, his figure of a time in for the unborn. Our being thrills with high, far memories and would bring down their dateless meanings here, but too divine for earthly nature's scheme, beyond our reach the eternal marvels blaze. Absolute they dwell, unborn, immutable, immaculate in the spirit's deathless air, immortal in a world of motionless time and an unchanging muse of deep self-space. Only when we have climbed above ourselves, a line of the transcendent meets our road and joins us to the timeless and the true. It brings to us the inevitable word, the godlike act, the thoughts that never die. A ripple of light and glory wraps the brain, and traveling down the moment's vanishing route, the figures of eternity arrive. Tempted to read the rest of the poem. Namaste. Jai Ma.